So he explained the situation and said, we've got to do entertainment. We've got to make it a good show. We got to make up for lost years. He said, and on behalf of Merck and Company, I'm authorized to start the ball rolling with a contribution of $100,000. Whereupon a number of chins dropped. And they all said, we have to go home and see what we can do. Well, we ended up with over $2 million. There were quite a few companies that came across matching Merck. Others with 50,000, 25, all the way down the list. And on that basis, we were able to hire the Boston Symphony to give us a concert at Philharmonic Hall. We couldn't get the Philharmonic because they were in Europe or somewhere touring. But we got the Boston down from Tanglewood. We opened up the Museum of Metropolitan Museum of New York. We arranged a banquet, 10 banquets simultaneously for the 10 symposia we organized. We had proteins, lipids, amino acids, all the topics. Each topic had a banquet. I was the host of the protein enzyme banquet. And these were all expensive private restaurants. We ran a good show. That's what all this paid for. Plus the fact that we gave all student applicants who were qualified round trip excursion fare from home base to New York and return, plus a per diem which allowed them to stay in inexpensive hotels, which we furnished a list of. So we had a lot of younger people there. Everybody says this was the greatest Congress ever organized. It was. Nobody ever came across with the kind of thing we did. The next Congress, which is now the International Union of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, will be in San Francisco in 1997. Ironically, the chairman of that organizing committee is my former postdoc, Bob Hill, who watched me go through all of this because he was in my lab in 61 to 64 when we did all of this. So that's the story. So from that, I got involved because Harrison Brown, who was then Foreign Secretary of the National Academy, decided to create an advisory committee on all international organizations and programs through the Academy. And he appointed me a member of that committee because of my experience in handling a lot of these things. And then after a year or 2 years, he made me chairman of the committee because the previous chairman, Al Noyes, had decided to retire from international working. You know, Al Noyes had been the editor of the JACS for many, many years. We became very good friends. And he said, look, you have all the younger contacts. I know all the has-beens. You take over. So that's how I got involved in that for a very long time.
In the 51 meeting when you've refused to fill the gaps and made the public statement as to why they weren't there, were there any repercussions?
Other people did the same thing. A few people filled the gaps. There were no real repercussions that I heard about, anyhow. It was an embarrassment, and that was it.
I'm just curious. I was just curious whether any political, whether the State Department had heard about it or whether they might have...
Well, when I later became chairman of the Advisory Committee on International Organizations and Programs, and we tried to get the Chinese from China to come to our meeting in 64, we wrote letters inviting them. I never got any answer from my Chinese friends. In fact, when we sent out the letters from my office here, they were returned by the post office as undeliverable. That's what happened to mail addressed to China. So what we did is we took all the same things, put them in new envelopes, and I mailed them over to a friend of mine in London and asked him to put British postage on them and send them on to China. We had the names of, I don't know, six or eight leading Chinese three of whom I knew because two of them had worked in Cambridge, Cayley's laboratory. Third one had worked with another friend of mine in Cambridge. So they all got invitations. They were filed. I was told when we went to China in 73, they got the invitations. There was nothing they could do about it. In 73, when Mr. Nixon decided to open up China, in the meantime, we had been agitating to try to get the Chinese involved with no success, but finally in 73, things did happen.
I wanted to ask you about that trip to China because you evidently met with Chou En-lai at that time.
Yes. Well, what happened in 72. We had created in the academy, with the cooperation of the American Council of Learned Societies and the Social Science Research Council, a committee called the Committee for Scholarly Communication with the People's Republic of China, which was wishful thinking. But it was, you know, we had a letterhead, and we had a mail drop at the academy to let the Chinese know that whenever they were ready, we were here. We tried to get in touch in various ways. For example, on a trip to Sweden, I had talked to Arne Tezelius, who had been invited by the Chinese and had made a tour of China. And I told him to write the Chinese and let them know whenever they were ready, we were ready to open negotiations and either meet on neutral ground or they were welcome here. They got all the word. I had also done this with a friend of mine who was then the director of the SIBA Foundation who had been to China. So they got all the words, but they weren't ready, but we were available. In the meantime, I was chairman of the advisory committee for all the international things, but I refused to serve on the China committee because it wasn't doing anything. There's no point in my being attached to a committee. In fact, the man we had as chairman of the committee was a China scholar from Columbia. In 1971, he died suddenly. And then Harrison Brown asked me to take over as chairman because he thought that a chairman from the social sciences was the wrong message. Chinese would be very more sensitive to that than a natural scientist. And it looked as though things were beginning to get over the Cultural Revolution a little bit in China, because some word had come around that some Chinese were visiting Europe. So I said, okay. Then in 62, we got word that a full-fledged Chinese delegation was planning to visit France and Canada. And in the meantime, Kissinger had made his trip to China, and there was talk about a Nixon visit to China. So we wrote to the Chinese inviting them, if they were going to be coming to Canada, to come and visit us in the United States. After the Nixon visit, we got a reply saying yes. So I flew to Washington, and they came down from Canada, and we welcomed them to come here. And we had a reception for them, and they visited the Boston area and Chicago and out to the West Coast. In the meantime, I had to go back to teach. So after I saw them in Washington, I flew home. And then on their final stop in San Francisco, my wife and I flew up and stayed in the same hotel with them. And that's when they arranged to invite us to send the delegation to China. So Harrison Brown and I very carefully selected a delegation that would appeal to them. A few people from the humanities and the social sciences, but mostly natural scientists. We picked George Harrah, the retired director of the Rockefeller Foundation who had created the Green Revolution, one of the world's great agronomists. We selected Glenn Seaborg. We knew the Chinese were interested in atomic energy. and its uses. We selected Carl Gerassi, who had been one of the inventors of the pill, and the president of the Social Science Research Council, the president of the Council of Learned Societies were invited. And then we invited a number of people who would be useful to us, like Max Leur, who was the retired curator of the Oriental Art Collections at Harvard, who had lived in China for 9 years doing art history work there. We invited Al Feuerwerker, who was professor of history and Chinese history and literature at Michigan, whose wife was Chinese, and so on. So we had on our delegation 6 or 7 people who spoke and read Chinese. So our delegation of about 17 or 18 people went over to China, and we spent a month there, basically from May 15th, June 15th, 1973. And as in the course of that meeting with Zhou Enlai, that we agreed on a scientific exchange program. That's the history of it.
What was your feeling as you either talked to him or interacted with him?
Very exciting. He was undoubtedly one of the brightest people I've ever met in my life. We followed protocol. I would speak in English, he translated into Chinese. He spoke in Chinese, it would be translated into English. While the translations were going on, he and I were speaking in English. Because we sat next to each other. He spoke English with a very strong accent, a rather guttural accent, but he clearly understood every word, because when the translator, Nancy Tang, who was a graduate of Vassar, didn't say precisely what he had said in Chinese, he corrected her English. He made it very clear that we're ready for scientific exchanges, but we're not quite ready for exchanges in current history and the social sciences. He said it'll come, but not yet. Archaeology, anthropology, art history, any of the sciences, no problem whatsoever. You work out the details with my colleagues. But the other things will have to wait a little bit. Now, he was already a pretty sick man at that time. As we now know, he was dying of cancer, and he died a year later, essentially, less than a year later. While the translations were going on, he asked me to identify all the people by face from our delegation. So there came a point when he was talking about some point of history or science, of looking directly at that person he could talk to about them. He had the full dossiers memorized of every single person on our delegation. After this was all over, he escorted my wife and me out to the door of the Great Hall. And on the way, he dispensed with the translator. He knew that I had been involved in this committee for a long time. He knew that I was friendly with these two biochemists who were in Shanghai and one in Peking. He knew that I had written to invite people to attend the Congress in New York in 64. He knew the whole history of our committee. And he said something to the effect. He said, "You must be very pleased now that this has come to pass. It's been a long time, hasn't it?" And I said, "I am very pleased. I've waited a long time. Great satisfaction. to bring China back into communication in the world of science, and with the hope of peace in the world. And then he stopped, and he looked at us, and he waved his hands. He said, "But you must admit that President Nixon has done one good thing." I said, "I agree." He says, "But Watergate." The hearings were all taking place at that time.
Oh.
And we knew about it only because Harrison Brown had a shortwave radio and would report to us at breakfast every morning what was happening. Otherwise, we were out of the country. But he knew all about it. So our final words were, I said to him, "But that will make no difference to our academy and to our committee whatsoever, regardless of what Watergate leads to. We are ready to continue our work indefinitely." He grabbed my hand with both of his and says, "Thank you. Thank you so much. Very good to hear." That was the last we saw of Joe Enlai. So, there's Nancy Tang with Joe Enlai and me.
That's a good picture.
Well, they obviously took that picture.
Yes.
And these are some of the people with whom I spent my life. I don't know whether you've seen any of these.
Well, I think the last time you told me
I don't know whether you want that on or not.
Well, we'll leave it on. We can cut it out.
Well, this is Max Bergman. Selig Hecht, with whom I took my degree. David Kalin, who's my professor in Cambridge. And this is the picture that I took.
That's a good picture.
Yeah. And that appears in a book of his, which his daughter edited after he died. She has the negative. This is Vickery, with whom I worked in New Haven. This is another picture of Selig Hecht, which appeared in Time magazine. Friend Oscar Wintersteiner with the first crystals of sodium penicillin. Otto Meyerhoff and John Etzel.
Yes.
Abe White. Claude Fromageau from Paris. Bill Handler. Stein and Moore. Willie Kuhner. The man who first used the detergent to extract the protein.
Oh.
Used bile salts, which he discovered, to extract rhodopsin from the eye. He also discovered myosin, the contractile protein in the muscle. Very remarkable scientist. Stein and Moore again. And then my surviving co-authors in 1971, Phil Handler and Abe White, when we were having an authors meeting at the National Academy in Washington.
That's a great job of all of you together. Where is that working session like that? That is working session.
Taken by Phil Sonder. And Frederick Allen Hopkins, more than anybody else, the founder of modern biochemistry.
Excellent collection.
Yep. Okay, I'm going to make another brief stop.
Okay.
I get talked out after 2 hours, which I think are historically interesting. You have it on?
Yes.
When we arrived in Beijing, I was asked if I would be willing to give a talk. And of course, I was aware of the fact that they might so want, so I had brought slides with me, appropriately. And we were planning to be in Beijing for about 9 or 10 days, and every day they kept postponing when I would give my talk. And finally, they set a date, which was around about a week after we had arrived there. In the meantime, I had been interested in trying to visit the biophysics lab because I knew about one of the people who was there, whom I had met at the International Congress of Biochemistry in Moscow in 1961, which was the last time the Chinese had attended an international congress. Because it was at that congress we had also admitted Taiwan. They refused to participate because Taiwan. Our policy being we admit scientists from every country, regardless of whether you want to call it what you want to call it. But they withdrew. So one of the people I had met there was one of the Chinese at that meeting. And I knew about him because he had worked in Kalin's lab after I left, and after all, I had gotten all the reprints from there. So I knew about his work anyhow. Finally, they said, today we'll visit the Institute of Biophysics. I said, fine. And I came to his laboratory. We said, hello. I looked around the lab, and I asked what he was doing. And the answers were marvelously evasive. We are planning to work on so-and-so. We are planning to work on so-and-so. We are intending to do this. Not that we have been doing it, but there was quite clear that all the bottles were clean and full of water. Constant temperature bath was stirring along, but there was nothing in it. There wasn't a used thing in the laboratory. And they had been waiting to bring him back from the farm so that he could act as my interpreter when I gave my talk. Because there was nobody else there who knew enough biochemistry to be able to do it. Later on, I found out from him that he had been out on the farms indeed, that they had brought him back for a few days and got him some clothes and everything else. And that after he was back, they never sent him back to the farm again. So he told everybody I saved his life. We've become very good friends since then. And in our second visit to China in 1980, we had dinner at his home. Well, I gave that talk. And you know, with interpretation and with questions, it was a 3 or 4 hour talk. And a rather small group of people there. The atmosphere was curious. People were afraid to say anything. And the Cultural Revolution was really not over. It was beginning to reopen up a little bit. Now, we had been asked when we arrived and given a long list of things that we might want to visit. Everybody had different institutes, different things they wanted to see. Turned out that George Harar and I were the only two who had wanted to visit the Institute of Botany. And we arrived at the Institute of Botany. Custom in China, standing at the sidewalks as they knew we were coming from the hotel, waiting for us with 3 or 4 of the senior people from the Institute. We're introduced, shake hands. Our interpreter is with us. And Chinese custom, you're first taken in for tea. Conversation, he told us about the Institute. We go through the main building, and it's a traditional kind of botany place. A lot of leaf presses, a lot of geology, history of plants. We're now going to go into some outbuildings where we have plant biochemistry and plant physiology. We're out there. About 100 yards away, I see a familiar figure that I hadn't seen since about 1932 or 33. A man that I knew at Woods Hole with whom I used to play ping pong. In fact, he really taught me how to play ping pong. He was the most distinguished plant biochemist in China and the former head of the Institute of Botany until he refused to go along with the Cultural Revolution. And Chinese, you know, rather formal, and except for closer relatives, you don't embrace, you don't hug, you don't do what Frenchmen or Europeans do in general. But I said, Tang, and he said, Emil, we rushed and threw our arms around one another, and everybody looked very startled. We explained that we were old friends, we hadn't seen each other. From about 1932 or 33, when he went back to China, since 1973, 40 years. So he told me what he was doing in the lab, and he was actually working. They never sent him out to the farm, because he was already not a young man. But he'd been demoted from, kicked out of his professorship at the university and demoted. And every time we were alone, he'd say, "I'll be all right, don't worry about me." He says, "Send me reprints, send me books, tell people to send me reprints. And if I don't answer, don't worry about it. I'll get everything. Just be careful what you say." Somebody would join us immediately. This went on. When we were back there in 1980, he was in all his glory. He had been restored to a nice new apartment. He was an honored figure. The Cultural Revolution was over. He died a couple of years ago. He was in the late 80s or 90s. When we went down to Shanghai finally, after a big tour, I met at the railroad station by Wang Ying Lai, whom I'd also met in 61, who was the head of the Institute of Biochemistry. And he immediately said, "I want you to give a lecture. Not tomorrow, next day. 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, our institute." I said, "Fine." So I decided to talk about evolution of proteins. Good general topic in which I can bring in a lot of protein structure, a lot of activity, change of function, all this kind of thing. So I lectured from 9 o'clock until about 12:30, then we broke for lunch. "Would I come back in the afternoon and answer questions?" I said, "Of course." 2 o'clock we started in again. Very easy to judge an audience when you speak in English and then wait for the translation. I could understand how many understood English because they laughed at the jokes. And those who laughed when the Chinese came on. One way of... I discovered this trick years before in Europe, actually. But most of the time you didn't have to speak and have it translated. First question from one of the Chinese, "Professor Smith, you first became famous for your work on proteolytic enzymes, but you haven't said anything about proteolytic enzymes. Have you stopped working on proteolytic enzymes?" "No." So I explained a little bit some of the subtle isomorphs and the other things. With translation and whatnot, this takes quite a while to go through this. Next question. "Professor Smith, you showed us all of this beautiful work on sequences on so many different proteins, but you didn't tell us how you did it." And this, I discovered, was the real problem. Intellectually, they could grasp everything you had to say. They had no idea about the methodologies. They were completely cut off. So, with a certain amount of prompting, I spent until about 6 o'clock talking about methods. Not a certain amount. The next year, they sent a delegation over here to spend 3 days in the laboratory to learn and copy all the methods. And this is really the problem of cutoff. You can read the journals, you can understand the ideas, but until you see it done or know how it's done, there's no way of appreciating an experimental science. The physicists and the mathematicians have an easier time.
So they did have access to the journals,
also? Oh, yeah. They had access to the journals.